More score sheets.
How are you? First of all, thank you so much for sticking around, for coming out. Those of you that have been around since this morning are unquestionably on overdrive. Your gas tanks have been filled with a lot of phenomenal shiurim, my own son-in-law's, which I was zocheh to hear this morning. And what can I tell you except that you're a lucky, lucky community to have someone like my son-in-law, and even more so, someone like my daughter.
You know that.
That's why you're here. I realize that. And they're lucky to have you. I want you to know that. They're lucky to have you. My father, Olivet Shalom, Rabbi Sender Gross, used to always say that every community deserves its rabbi and every rabbi deserves its community. And yes, for better, for worse, but this is only for better.
The topic of today is going to be Miriam. And in reality, Miriam is the one person, I believe, perhaps in all of Tanakh, that we kind of feel we have a grip on her. We know her. We heard her stories, we know her stories, we know what happened to her. And why bother delving any deeper into her? In fact, the very title of Miriam is sort of like, boring, yawn. You know, give us something like Chulda, give us something exciting, someone we never heard about, go analyze Abigail. But Miriam, you know, give me a break. But on the other hand, I really believe that Miriam is probably the most complex and enigmatic of all the figures of Tanakh. And I'd like to really explore and analyze certain points about her with you this afternoon. So to launch our discussion, I'd like to begin with three questions. Question number one. Every day in davening, in Shacharit, we are told that we should remember six different things. We call them the Shesh Zechirot. Six things that we are commanded to remember on a daily basis. And if you look in your siddur right after Shacharit, you'll see every siddur has it, the Shesh Zechira. Amongst them, we have three positive and three negative things to remember. The three positive things are we're commanded to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. We're commanded to remember Kabbalat HaTorah, the giving and receiving of the Torah. And we're also commanded to remember Shabbos. On the flip side, we're also commanded to remember three negative events. We're commanded to remember the Egel HaZahav, the golden calf. We're commanded to remember Amalek, and we're commanded to remember what God did to Miriam. Now, obviously, in these Shesh Zechirot, what immediately stands out is the fact that five of the six are national events, either three national tragedies, national sins, two of them, or on the positive side, three national, wonderful, historic events. Why is it that of these Shesh Zechirot, we are actually commanded to remember the actions of one particular person? That's not a national event. That's one person. And I need not even follow that up with the question of what was so terrible about what she did. Lashon Hara, fine. Lashon Hara is not good. We know that. But is it worse than Chil Shabbos? Is it worse than eating treif? Is it worse than murdering? At most, it's similar to that. Why this woman commanded to be remembered every single day? That's the first question. The second question is that in our parsha of Parshat Chukat that we are about to read this Shabbos, we know that Miriam dies. This is all taking place in the 40th year of the Jewish people in the desert. Miriam dies, and both Aharon and Moshe commit a crime. What it is exactly, we're going to touch upon a little bit later, but I don't want to go into right now. But they commit a crime where they are sentenced to death before entering Eretz Yisrael in the 40th year. Now, I understand God has commanded, God has sentenced them to death, that they will not see Eretz Yisrael. But did it ever occur to us to ask, what about Miriam? Why does she get killed off? I understand she committed a crime with Lashon Hara. What was her punishment? She was Mitzora. She was a leper for 7 days. That was embarrassing. That was tremendously, tremendously, you know, an effective punishment. Bnei Yisrael all saw and they waited. They waited for her. She's punished. You know, shine, finished. Why can't she own her? And finally, thirdly, I would like to understand how a woman who in Sefer Shmot, the book of Exodus, was lionized, Miriam. How in the world did it happen that she could fall so precipitously as to be vilified to the point where not only is her lashon hara spelled out for us in the Torah, but that we forever are commanded to remember? Those are the three questions that we are going to be analyzing today.
So to begin with, on the top of your sheets, on top of your source sheets, what I've just mentioned in source number one was the memory and the commandment to remember Miriam. And in source 1b, which is on the left side, I tried to get most of this translated into English. I think everything except for one source is in fact translated. We know that the Gemara Tanis tells us, Shlosha parnasim tovim amdu li Yisrael. Eluhen, Moshe, v'Aharon, v'Miriam. There were three great leaders that stood for the Jewish people throughout the slavery and in the desert. Gimel matanot tovot nitnu al yadam. And there were three gifts given through them because of them. The Eluhen, and these were them. Be'er, the well of water, was given due to Miriam. The Anan, the cloud of glory that protected the Jewish people, was given due to Aharon because of Aharon. Uman, and the manna that fell from heaven, was given to the Jewish people because of Moshe. So what clearly the Gemara does is equate the greatness of Miriam with her brothers, Moshe and Aharon. All the more so, the question is reinforced. What is going on here? Why are we forever commanded to remember her as a sinner? Why doesn't one of our rabbis tell us every single day, remember all the glorious things that Miriam did for us, and we will discuss those? Only the sin that she committed? Preposterous. In Parshat Shlach, the parsha that we just completed, source 2, the Torah tells us, Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. God spoke to Moshe saying, Shlach lecha anashim, send people, individuals, V'yaturu et Eretz Kanaan, and let them spy the land of Israel, asher ani noten livnei Yisrael, that I am about to give the Jewish people. Rashi, in understanding the juxtaposition of the sending of these spies, of these meragim, right after the speech, the lashon hara of Miriam, which happened just before this, explains the following. He says, source number 3 in Rashi, Shlach lecha anashim, lama nismecha parshat meraglim the parshat Miriam? Why the juxtaposition of the lashon hara of Miriam to the sending of the spies? Lefi shelakta al iskei diba shedibra ba'achiha, urishaim halalu ra'u velo lakhu musar. The English is on the left. Why?
Explains Rashi, because these people should have known better. They have just come off seeing what happened to Miriam who spoke lashon hara. They have just come off seeing the anger and ire of God at someone that speaks against another. And here these meraglim, these spies, were led on to Eretz Yisrael. They were commanded to go to Israel to look at this wonderful land that Moshe had promised via God, that God promised via Moshe, is a land that is tova, me'od me'od, is a great land. Eretz avat chalav udvash, a land flowing with milk and honey. You should have known better not to talk lashon hara about Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, the juxtaposition of the lashon hara of Miriam at the end of Parshat Bahalotcha and the sending of the spies at the beginning of Parshat Shlach. What? How does that make sense? Lashon hara about a person versus coming back with a fair, at least in their eyes, report about Eretz Yisrael. How does that make sense? What's the connection? Soloveitchik explains. What Miriam did, Miriam's sin, was that she failed to see the singularity, the uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu. And due to that, she spoke lashon hara.
In her speech, and if you turn with me for one moment, please, to the third page, where it says page 3, and we see there her speaking. top of the page on the right or on the left, if you prefer it in English. V'tadaber Miriam v'Aharon b'Moshe al odot ha'isha ha'kushit asher lakach ki isha kushit lakach. What she spoke about, we will discuss very shortly. But what did she say? She said, Vayomru, harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem, halo gam banu diber. She said, whatever it is that Moshe did, whether he took or divorced, whatever it is that he did, he thinks he's special. He thinks he's above the rest of us. He thinks he's extraordinary, where the rules that apply to the masses don't apply to him. Gam banu diber. We too are Nevi'im. We too are prophets. Why does he think he's any different than the rest of us? His failure to understand that Moshe was different, that Moshe was unique, is at the heart of what was wrong with Moshe's speech, with Miriam's speech. Now turn back to page one, please, again. Sure. I will try. We have seats up here if you'd like to sit up here. The air conditioner. Okay. I will try. Thank you for pointing that to me. Okay. Moshe sends the Meraglim. He sends the Meraglim to spy out, to scout out, to tour the land of Israel. He doesn't expect them to look at the land of Israel like Uganda. He doesn't expect them to come back with a report about the land the same way he would if you were thinking of moving to Boca. I recommend it, by the way. That's not the issue. Don't you understand that when you send spies to see Eretz Yisrael, your yardstick, the measuring rod is different. Because Eretz Yisrael is a singular, extraordinary land. And don't come back and tell me you can't move to Israel because their shopping bags are not strong enough. That's not even something to consider about Eretz Yisrael. If you want to keep it in the back of your mind so that you know that you should pack your own shopping bags, fine. But that's why you shouldn't move to Eretz Yisrael. What the Meraglim failed to realize was exactly what Miriam failed to realize, was the specialness, the singularity, the uniqueness of certain individuals. And it was true about Moshe, and it's true about Eretz Yisrael. And that's what Rashi means when he explains the juxtaposition of these two events as being the lack of recognition of singularity. Why is that? What happened? What went wrong?
Tell me if I'm screaming.
What went wrong? Why couldn't Miriam see what was so obvious? Obvious to all of us. That Eretz Yisrael is not just any land. That Moshe is not just anybody. What was wrong with this picture? What happened? I suggest to you that what happened was that Miriam was a product of a generation of Dor Mitzrayim, the generation of the slavery of Egypt. What do I mean by this? The generation Dor of Mitzrayim, of slavery, was a generation that was set up to equalize everybody, to knock down the erroneous hierarchy that was set up by the brothers back in the day when they really believed that if you were the children of Rachel, you were better than the children of Leah and better than the children of the Shvachot. They set up their own idea of who is more important and what values make one greater. And that led to Sinat Chinam, and it led to the selling of Yosef to Mitzrayim, and it led to eventually Shibud Mitzrayim, slavery. Because what slavery does, like no other event, is it reduces everybody to sameness. It expunges name, shame, and reduces you to nothing but numbers. And we, the generation that are living still with survivors around who have numbers on their arms, understand this perhaps more than any previous generations hundreds of years ago, perhaps. Because we understand what Holocausts do. You could have been a rabbi, you could have been a shoemaker, you could have been a beggar, you could have been the wealthiest guy on the block. But when you're in Auschwitz, when you're in the camps, guess what? You're the same. And it doesn't matter who your father was, and it doesn't matter who your grandfather was. You're the same. And God needed to even the playing field, to once and for all make this an even system where the masses felt that they were the same, in order for God to then later go and create a hierarchy based on Torah values. If you look in source 4, the Torah in Sefer Devarim tells us, Ve'etchem lakach Hashem vayotzi etchem mikur habarzel. Kor habarzel is known as the iron furnace. Mitzrayim is referred to as the iron furnace. Why? What happens in a furnace? Everything is melded and welded together. It's a melting pot. And Chazal understand in that word barzel that that has a reference to something even deeper than just an iron furnace, but that the letters are an acronym, that Beit stands for Bilhah, and Reish of Barzel stands for Rachel, and Zion stands for Zilpah, and Lamed for Leah. Because that erroneous hierarchy that had been set up as to who the greater people were, now all of the children of Bilhah, of Rachel, of Zilpah, and of Leah have been thrown together in a holocaust of Mitzrayim to equalize, to even the playing field. And that's who Miriam is. I'd like to now spend about 10 minutes discussing Miriam and understanding who she was in Mitzrayim. And if you can, keep in mind this notion as we move through these sources to cover and to analyze what it is that was special about this woman, so that we can then understand what went wrong. Okay? Everybody with me? You're good? You can hear? Not too cold, not too hot, not that I can do anything about it, but everybody's okay. Okay. You're good. Thank God. Okay. Source number 5. Okay. Beginning of Sefer Shmot, the Torah tells us that there were two midwives, Mialdot, Lamialdot ha'ivriyot asher shem ha'achat Shifra v'shem ha'shenit Puah. There were two women, and they were called by names that were not their own names. They were called by names that were descriptive of what they do. One was a Shifra, and one was a Puah. Who were these women? So the Gemara actually has an argument. The Gemara says either it was Isha Ubita, a woman and her daughter, or it was Isha v'chamota, or it was a woman and her daughter-in-law, or her mother-in-law. Either it was Yocheved and Elisheva, who was the wife of Aharon, or it was Yocheved and her daughter Miriam. Now, let's understand that Miriam at the time was 5 years old. Aharon was 3 years older than Moshe. The Torah tells us at one point when they stood in front of Paro, Aharon was 83 years old and Moshe was 80 years old. Thank you so much. If I had a choice between a mother and her daughter, and the daughter that would be one of these midwives was over 5 years old, and a mother and her daughter-in-law, in which case the daughter-in-law would be older, how old we don't know exactly, but potentially teenage or preteen, and these girls were going to be midwives, simple logic, sensibility would tell me, choose the mother and daughter-in-law over the mother and the 5-year-old daughter. Do you agree? Mm-hmm. So why is it that Rashi, along with almost all of our commentaries, say, no. It had to be Yocheved and Miriam. Yocheved and the five-year-old daughter. Really weird. And we would have to say certainly that she was wife for her age. But there's another reason, I believe. And I'm suggesting this to you. None of this is Torah L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, except for Torah L'Moshe Mi-Sinai. The answer is because what is Shifra? Shifra means Mishaperet, as Rashi says, to beautify. And that's what Yocheved's job was. Okay? She took that child out and she cleaned it up. And she made it clean and made it beautiful. That's what Shifra is. But pua, on the other hand, comes from the word to coo, to speak, to calm. Chazal, Rashi in the lead, are telling us that if there's one girl that had the power through her mouth, through her words, through her voice, to affect any kind of change, it had to be Miriam. It had to be Miriam. And therefore Rashi, despite the fact that this girl was only 5 years old, tells us that Miriam was that girl. Miriam was Pua. Later on, as we move in that same source 5, it tells us, Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, vayikach et bat Levi, that a man went from the house of Levi and married the daughter of Levi. This is referring to Amram marrying Yocheved. And they will very shortly have a son, who they will name Moshe. Actually, they don't name him, Bat Paro names. But the point is, what does that mean, Vayelech, and what does that mean, Vayikach? Where's he going? What's he taking? So Rashi, again, based on Medrash, tells us that it was due to the words of Miriam that he went ahead and took his wife back. She then goes ahead, and we see her again a few psukim later, as underlined again in Pasuk Dalet. Vatetatsev achoto merachok. His sister, Moshe's sister, stands from afar. Now, what have I noticed in three times that we see Miriam mentioned? There's no mention of Miriam. There's no name. My friends, the beginning of Sefer Shemot, as Bnei Yisrael fall deeper into slavery, it is a study of the loss of names. Because names are identity. Names are meaning. Name makes you special. We call God Hashem, the name, because he encompasses all that is special and meaningful. The Jewish people at the beginning of Sefer Shemot lose their names. They start out Reuben, Shimon, we list the Shvatim, and then that's it. There's no mention of names except for Moshe's. And there's a slight digression at one point just to give us the genealogy so we understand the backdrop of who Moshe was and his family. But names are not mentioned because the Jewish people became one, equal, the same, numbers. Vayishritzu, the Torah tells us. And Vayishritzu, they gave birth like rats. They were nameless. There was nothing special that distinguished or differentiated one from another. Everything was the same. And therefore, even Miriam, she's Pua, she's assumed, and once again, she is the sister, but we don't know who she is yet. If you turn the page, please, to source 2. What did Miriam tell her father? If you look at source 8. Look at source 8. I'm going to read it in English. And a man went from the house of Levi and took the daughter of Levi. He was separated from her because of Paro's decree. Now he returned and took her again. And he went means he went after his daughter's advice. She said to him, "Your decree is worse than Paro's. Paro only decreed against the males, and you have also decreed against the female children." So he returned to her, meaning to his wife, Yocheved, and rewed. She had the ability to speak to her father, to persuade her father to take his wife back so that Moshe could be born. If you look down a little bit more to source 10, Pua, on the left side where it's bracketed. Shehofia panim kineged paro. Vizakva chotmobo. Amrolo. Oilo toha ish kishiavo ha elokim. Litboa mimenu. Ulifara mimenu. Whoa, she said to Paro, is the man that God is going to visit one day and going to punish because of the evil that you are doing and that you are commanding. So here's this woman who, according to our rabbis, she was Pua. She was the one that was able through her mouth to coo and to calm and placate the child. She is the Pua that was able to stand up against her father and persuade him with words. She is the Pua that was even able to stand up in front of Paro and give him some of her mind. Miriam is called a Nevi'ah. She is one of the seven prophetesses. One of only seven. Nevi'ah or Nevuah, Navi, comes from the word Niv Sfatayim, the movement of the lips. Miriam was all about her words, her speech, the force of the word, and the power of speech. That is who Miriam was. And even when Miriam was given an opportunity to stand out, to be different, when Moshe took the men after Kriyat Yamsuf, and Moshe took the men aside and sang his glorious Az Yashir, and then Miriam was able to persuade the women and took them aside, and she was able to sing with them. The Torah records her song. It's her 15 minutes. Sing something amazing. Give me an ode that everybody will say, whoa, that's Miriam's. And what does she say instead? If you look inside, source 11, Vata'am lahem Miriam, Shiu la'ashem ki ga'oga'a, Sus v'rochvo rama bayam. Does that sound familiar? Of course. She merely echoed what Moshe, her brother, had said. Because to Miriam, nobody was able to stand out. Everybody was equal. And Miriam was synonymous with that generation. She led that generation. We're told by our rabbis that the Shifcha al Hayam saw a greater Nevi'im later, Yechezkel ben Buzi, was able to see. The plain maid servant on the sea was able to see everything. Because everybody was still equal in Miriam's eyes. Miriam was a child of the Holocaust. Miriam was a child who refused to accept any kind of hierarchy. And now I'd like you to turn your pages, please, to the next page. So what went wrong? What went wrong? After Yetzias Mitzrayim, as the Rav had said, a concept of segula, of singularity, of specialness, became incorporated into the Jewish people, where certain things were simply holier than other things. Certain individuals were more distinguished than others. There were distinctions that had to be made and accepted by the Jewish people. Amongst them, Eretz Yisrael. Amongst them, the Kedusha of Kohanim. Amongst them, different levels of Nevuah. And Miriam could not accept that. Miriam could not accept that. And that's what happens when she hears one day that Eldad and Medad, two individuals that became Nevi'im, are now prophesying, and she's standing near Tzipporah, and as the Medrash tells us in Source 14, I will read it in English, the underlined words. She initiated the conversation and therefore was written first. How did Miriam know that Moshe had separated from his wife? She was with Tzipporah when they saw Eldad and Medad prophesying in Tzipporah, said, "Woe unto the wives of those that are subject to prophecy, for they will separate from their wives like my husband has separated from me." She heard that Moshe had separated from his wife. What she didn't know was that God commanded Moshe, "Va'ata amod poimadi, stay here with me. You have to be in a perpetual state of holiness. You cannot go back, Moshe, to living with your wife." And according to our rabbis, Moshe separated from his wife, not understanding what she saw. This woman who once again was responsible for the very birth of Moshe, this woman who stood and watched to see what would happen to her brother, the most dedicated of sisters, suddenly she couldn't tolerate that. What do you mean? It is a mitzvah to be married. This is what we all do. If anything, I persuaded your father to remarry our mother so that you could be born. And now you're separating yourself? You're taking this upon yourself? This which is not the way of the masses? She could not accept. Now, what her speech was actually about is an interesting discussion in and of itself, one that we don't have too much time to go into, but since I brought it, I will mention two quick sources, two different opinions as to what actually happened, what this Isha Kushit, this dark woman, who this actually was. So according to, if you look in Source 14 again, Ha'isha HaKushit, in Source 14 in Hebrew, Al Shem Noya Nikra Kushit, she was called dark because she was beautiful. Because she was beautiful. And there are all sorts of different interpretations. Rashi himself struggles between three different possibilities of why she's referred to as this Isha Kushit, who was Tzipora, who Moshe had married many years earlier. But we're talking about it now, not because he married her, but he's talking about the woman that Moshe had married that he had now divorced. But there's a very interesting interpretation, which again, I don't want to leave this until you see, because it's just an interesting interpretation, of the Evan Kaspi. And the Evan Kaspi says something amazing. He says, again, this is in Source 15, the Evan Kaspi, where it is underlined, I will read. Moses took an Cushite or Ethiopian woman. What happened was as follows. After Moses married Tzipporah, he took another wife, an Ethiopian, a woman for reasons best known to himself. And it is not our business to pry into his motives. He must certainly have known what he was about. We are not told when this event happened, whether at the moment of its mention, during the journey in the wilderness, or before. Other events, too, are not recorded in the Torah, since the matter had not been mentioned hitherto, and we should not be surprised at the statement because of the Ethiopian woman he had married. The text adds the words, "for he had taken, married an Ethiopian woman." So whereas Rashi holds that what Miriam is talking about is the fact that Moshe had now taken it upon himself the right to separate from Tzipporah, the Evan Kaspi says, what are you talking about? It has nothing to do with Tzipporah. Moshe had married a wife in addition to Tzipporah. But the point is not who this Cushite woman really was, because we have a varying degree of different opinions. The issue is that Miriam spoke about it because it was something that was unusual. People in those days just didn't take another woman. And people in those days just didn't separate from their wife. So whatever commentary, whatever opinion you would like to take or accept, the point is not, again, who the Cushite woman was. The point was that it was out of the ordinary. And Miriam couldn't understand something that would be out of the ordinary. In her mind, that's going backwards. That's going back to pre-Shibud Mitzrayim, pre-slavery times, when there was this false hierarchy and people thought they were special and they were different and therefore I could take this privilege. No, says Miriam, that's bad times. Don't go there. We're all the same. We're all in it together. Now we understand the thinking of Miriam, and we understand why God was so perturbed by her speech. Because her speech had at its root an inability to accept distinctions between people. An inability to accept that some people
by God's right and God's insistence, are holier than others. A very difficult concept for even us to understand. Why does a Kohen get up there and he's able to bless the people when there are people sitting in the audience that might be bigger Talmidei Chachamim than the Kohen? It's hard to understand. But it's a notion that requires acceptance because God desired that hierarchy. And that's the root, my friends, of Lashon Hara. I've been to so many seminars, and so much has been spoken about Lashon Hara. Don't speak slander, don't gossip, don't. Terrible sin. And we all agree, we all know it. We've been the victims of Lashon Hara, I believe every one of us, we all know. But what I don't believe has ever been answered to us is, why do we speak Lashon Hara? Is it just to fill the time? Is it because it's fun? It is. All of the above. But what do we do about it? How do we prevent it other than saying, I'm not going to speak Lashon Hara, 10 minutes later I speak Lashon Hara? What do we do about it? I believe that what Miriam gives us is an insight into understanding what provokes Lashon Hara. And therefore, it's part of the Zechirah, it's something we have to remember every day. Because at the bottom of Lashon Hara is our inability to accept that people are different. I judge others by what I think is right. How could she wear white after Labor Day? Right? Whatever notions, whatever wisdom is out there, whatever I've accepted upon myself as being the right way, this is how you should parent your children. This is how you should talk. This is what you should wear. I judge others by my standards. And therefore, I can't, as you learned before, a word, fagin, other people. I can't fagin. I can't believe she did that. And if we can understand that people are different, they're people of shame, they're people of note, everybody has a shame, then we could start to say, she has different standards. She has a different way. It works for her. Or it doesn't work for her. That's her decision. What this also does, I believe, is give us a phenomenal understanding of all the parshiot that we are now encountering, some that we've already encountered, and others that we are right now walking through the portions of the week that we read in shul, on Shabbos, and even during the week. And let me explain to you what I mean. We have a parshat Korach. What happens in parshat Korach? Source 16. Torah tells us that Korach had an issue. What was Korach's issue? What was Korach's issue? This man, another individual mentioned, led a rebellion of 250 people and a lot of other sympathizers. What was his rebellion? So we learn through Medrash, through Rashi, that he was upset about the promotion of Elitzaphon to a position of leadership of Nasir when he felt it was coming to him. Fine. How would other people get involved? You have your itch, you have your problem, deal with it. I'm not going to join your rebellion because of that. And the Torah understands that. The Torah tells us what his rebellion is. If you look in Source 16, Vayikalu Moshe v'al Aaron v'yomer aleihem, Rav lachem, you Moshe and Aaron, you've taken too much for yourself. Why? Because kulam kidoshim u'betocham Hashem, u'madua titnasu al kahal Hashem. We're all holy. What makes you different? What makes you think that you can advance, that you're greater than the rest of us? God is in all of our midst, not just yours. So what you see is that Korach also is a product of the generation of Shibud Mitzrayim. He's another Miriam in a sense. Obviously, he's far more nefarious. I don't mean to equate the two. But his thinking has been shaped, has been honed by the same thinking of Shibud Mitzrayim. We're all equal. What do you think you are greater than us? That you can stand up there and do X, Y, or Z? That you can go into Ohel Moed? We're all the same. And it's fascinating that you know what happened? Rashi tells us, and this is in Source right, 16 right near that on the left side. You don't have to read it inside. I will just tell you, shorten for the sake of time. He bought a beged, a garment that was all tchelet, all blue. And he said to Moshe, this garment, certainly it's good for tzitzis, right? It's all blue. And what did Moshe tell him? What did Moshe say?
Still needs
what?
One blue string. Because what Korach was saying was that we're all the same. Why does anybody need one that's different? One that makes it holier, one that makes it kosher? We're all blue. And if we're all blue, we don't need anyone to distinguish us, to make us kosher, to make us holy. We're all blue. Kulam kedoshim. But that's not how it works. Despite the fact that you're all holy, despite the fact that the beged is all blue, you still need people that are distinct, people that are different, that are going to give you something more than that beged has without it. If you turn your pages finally to the last page, it's fascinating that Miriam passes the scepter of leadership to the Benot Tzlofchad, the daughters of Tzlofchad, which we are told, Tzlofchad, which we are told about at the end of Sefer Bamidbar. And when the Torah describes these girls in Perek Kaf Zayin, in Source 18, the Torah tells us, "Vatikravna benot Tzlofchad ben Chefer ben Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe lemishpachot Menashe ben Yosef." The Eile Shmot Benotav, Machla, Noah, Chagla, Milka, Vitirza. Now I ask you a question. We didn't even hear of Miriam's name in Sefer Shmot. She was involved in doing the most incredible things, feats of greatness. She's a sister, she's a pua. She's not even mentioned. Why are these girls each mentioned by name? So I would say that perhaps they're mentioned by name because they're each so different. But Rashi tells us in Source 19, Lamdechasha hayu kulam tzadikim. They were all the same. They were all tzadikim. And later on in Rashi, as you move down on that same Source 19, two lines from the bottom, Vatiyana machla tirza magicha kulan shkulot zokazo. They're all equal. What is it about these girls? These girls came to realize that you could be the same, but you're each distinct. You're all people of shame of name. And to underscore that notion, their names are mentioned individually not once, but twice in the Torah. You could be the same, but if you're a person with a shame, you're distinct. You're special. You have a name. And these Benot Tzlofchad, the generation of the Dor Dea, the generation of knowledge, they had the erudition, they had the discrimination to understand that each individual is different, so much so that that was their claim for the land of their dead father. And they say this when they appear to Moshe and Perakav Zion. They say three lines from the bottom in Source 18, Lama Yigara Shem Avinu. The land would have gone to the same tribe. What's the big deal? Because the name of our father would be missing. And every name and every individual is special. And he can't be lost to Kal Yisrael. And that is the shift from Miriam to the Benot Tzlofchad. And I suggest to you that the difference between the two is why Miriam could not go into Eretz Yisrael. Because she was a representative of a different mind, a different thought, a different mindset, a different generation. And her generation wouldn't work in a generation where God had set up a divine hierarchy that certain things and certain people are special and are distinct. And if we keep in mind, as one of our zechirot, what God did to Miriam, how even Miriam, who was the greatest, who brought about so much greatness for the women of Israel, she inspired the women of Israel, even she fell in the very conduit that she was able to bring about that greatness through her tongue, through her mouth, by speaking that Lashon Hara, because she failed to remember and recognize and accept that people are different. And that's what Chazal want us to keep in mind, which is why we have to remember that every day. So on one hand, Miriam's greatness, her rise to being a heroine in Israel, was due to her mouth, and her downfall is due to her mouth. Are there any questions, comments? Yes.
One explanation. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Her comment was, obviously, they were able to get past the notion.
It's interesting because they were not punished that they would not go into Eretz Yisrael. The women of her generation were not punished. But we don't know if they did go into Eretz Yisrael. Yes, but how many and what the percentage was? My assumption would be, and I don't know this, but my assumption would be that those that were able to get past the generation, the thinking of the Dor Mitzrayim, and able to embrace the thinking of the Dor Dea. See, knowledge, when you know something, I'll give you an example, okay? I'm decorating, I'm putting a new floor in my house. And I'm sure everybody has had the horrific experience of having to do some sort of decorating or you know, some sort of uplift or redoing of your house. To me, a white tile. I want a white tile. It didn't occur to me that there are 4,000 shades of white. Antique white, cream white, right? Because if you know, there's discrimination. The more you know, the more there's discrimination. To me, I know about three flowers. But a person that knows flowers understands every different type and every different, you know, difference between the flowers, where they grow, how they grow, what they grow with. That's knowledge. Knowledge brings discrimination. And the Benot Slavchad were a product of a generation of knowledge where they accepted and understood distinction. Yes, please.
So you're saying that this is different than what I was going to ask about, but based on what she's saying, I thought that the whole generation that came out of Mitzrayim were not allowed into Eretz Israel because they were of the slave mentality, and it was the next generation that went in.
The people
is
that...
just the men?
The Eben Ezra at one point explains that the purpose of the 40 years in the desert was because God wanted to kill out that generation, let them die off, because they would never be anything more than a generation of slaves, the mindset of a slave, and they would never have the courage to walk into Eretz Yisrael and do what they had to do. That's one understanding. But in terms of the sin of Moshe, which I really skipped over again because of time, but Moshe's sin, the sin of the Meraglim caused B'nai Yisrael, that happened in the beginning of the second year of the Jewish people in the desert, and that forced a punishment that all the men above 20 will be killed off in the desert for the next 40 years. Okay? But not except for Caleb and Yehoshua, the two spies that came back with a good report. In reality, there is no punishment and no sentence against the women. So the assumption is that these women, therefore, walked into Eretz Yisrael. I don't know what the case is. I don't know if that's true or if some of them died off too or if most of them died off too, but it wasn't that they were punished. My assumption based on this year would be that those that were able to embrace the generational thinking of the Dor Dea would have walked into Eretz Yisrael, and those that could not possibly didn't, as Miriam, who was not punished not to go into Eretz Yisrael, and yet she did not make it into Eretz Yisrael because she, again, was this locked into that generational thinking.
So why did Moshe send they knew what it was going to be like. It's like
so there's a story of the sending of the Meraglim into Eretz Yisrael that is told to us there in Parsha Tzlach in the book of Numbers, and there's another story that is told to us in Sefer Devarim in the book of Deuteronomy. And when you put the two together, the two have many differences. And the two together look something like this, again, according to depending on which commentary you go by, that B'nai Yisrael had initially come to Moshe and demanded that they go and send spies. God, in order to make this right, said, I'll tell you what, I will send you, but I will send you the way I want you to go so that it turns out to be a not only divine mission, but that you actually get a mitzvah for doing it, and I set it up right. So B'nai Yisrael first came, they had their whole different notion. It's like, you know, a kid that says, I want to backpack to Florida. So you go, I'm not letting you backpack, but here's what we're going to do. Because I know you're going to go anyhow, because I know that you're going to be an angry kid if you don't. I'll set it up for you so you take this bus, you can stay at this person's house, and that's what God did. That's according to the Ramban in different sources. Yes?
How would you relate
I'm not sure I accept your thesis that is true. I do believe.
Chicago, you don't understand.
Part of the community, part of what's going on in the Jewish world today.
I believe, and this Rav Soloveitchik actually says this in an essay, and he discusses this in maybe more than one place that I'm not aware of, but in the place that I am aware of, he discusses the fact that whereas there is a uniformity in externals, there is no uniformity, and in fact, we are told, and in fact, it is mandated to be distinct in your internally, in your thinking and how you feel and what you bring to the mitzvos. We all, for example, observe Shabbos in one way, despite differences in which rabbi says, you know, small differences. But whereas the externals are the same, the thinking and what makes the individual special should be different. Okay, Kishem, there's a famous verse that just like people's faces are different, kach deotam, that's how your thinking should be different. It is different than it should, and we applaud and we embrace differences in thinking and in thought. That doesn't necessarily mean that because we embrace thinking and differences and distinctions in people, in their thought, in their feelings, that it has to be a lack of uniformity in the actual actions. Does that help answer your question? Other than that, if you're referring to things that are really, you know, incorrect, it's just people judging other people by what they do, then you have to ask yourself, is what they're doing a value, a Torah value? And therefore, if they're not looking positively upon it, it's because it's not accepted, or it's not what Torah would want you to do, or is it something that just people like it this way? I just want to give you, you know, a small example, which is very interesting. In my school, my high school, there's a discussion every year about whether there should be uniforms or not. And inevitably, I don't know if that's true in Chicago. Okay. So inevitably, we have those parents that stand up in the board, correctly so, and say, I want my child to have individuality. I want them to be able to dress the way they feel. And I hear that argument. I hear that very, very seriously. But inevitably, every single girl is wearing the same Gap skirt. Okay? So not mandated by the school, and because there is amongst people social pressure. And social pressure is always, it's social pressure in what you wear, it's social pressure in where you go, what color you want your hair to be. That social pressure that is not necessarily Jewish, and it doesn't come from rabbis, it comes from social pressure. So if that's what you're referring to in your question, then I would say that's social pressure, that's dealing with any kind of social pressure. You know, what shoes are in, you know, what stylish, and et cetera, et cetera. Yes?
In defense of Miriam, maybe I missed something, but she sinned because she did not accept the specialness, the individuality of Moshe. Of
yes.
The Zemaraglim sinned because they did not accept the specialness.
Correct.
Of Israel.
Correct.
Much the same sin, and yet we remember her sin and not theirs.
That is true, but their sin was such that, first of all, it wasn't about another individual. We don't know those 10 Meraglim well. We only really know two of the Meraglim, the two that came back with a good report, especially, of course, Yehoshua. We don't know them well. With Miriam, we know her. We know what she did. We know how great she was. We know that she only had the best intentions for her brother. That's why it makes her such a more salient figure and one that we can learn so much more from. Otherwise, I would say, okay, what she did there, she does this every day, knew who's Miriam. But I know who Miriam was. I know this is a person who valued her brother, who in fact was really the one who really got the system going so that her brother could be born, who waited by watching what would happen to her brother. This was a woman who had only the most positive intentions. And even in her Lashon Hara, she had only the most positive intentions. She was worried about her sister-in-law Tzipora, or whoever this extra woman would be. And if she speaks Lashon Hara, and she has the gift of gab, she was a Neviah, and even she could speak Lashon Hara, because she didn't recognize that people are distinct and you can't judge others by your frame of reference, then I have a lesson that I can learn. Okay, yes, yes, please.
I have a question about Korah.
Yes.
Could you repeat the question?
Seemingly, Korah, the prime member of the they each wanted something different.
Correct.
But they didn't each want, they really didn't each want equality. They each just wanted to be in the higher class.
Okay.
So they weren't really looking for equality. They were just looking for.
what you're describing are some of the motives that are attributed to the 250 people from Shevet Reuven or Bechorot, as well as Korah. And as I said to you, Rashi and other commentators do that as well with the electing or the anointing of Elisaphon to a position that Korah himself felt. Everyone had their itch, okay? So it was a bunch of malcontents that came together to scream at Moshe. That is unquestionably how Chazal view this. However, what was written on their placard? What was written on their signs? What was it that they were screaming about that got sympathizers and everybody together saying, yeah, you're right, the Torah tells us. They didn't come and say it's not fair. They came and said, Kulam Kadoshim, we're all equal.
But it was more of a rallying cry than what they believed.
Clearly, but I'm saying that what they wrote on their placards, what they, you know, at the rally that they had, they weren't saying, I want to be Nasi or I want to be Moshe. That is what we know is behind it. But that's how they got people involved, because that was the thinking of the people, that Kulam Kedoshim, that the Beged is all Tchelet, what's your problem? And that, by the way, just as an additional note, and with this we'll go, was really the problem with Moshe hitting the rock twice. It was a lack of discernment as to when God says speak, hitting is not the same as speaking. And if God said hit it once, it's not the same as hitting it twice. Because each action, each mandate given by God is distinct and has its own purpose. And once you cloud that distinction, guys, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Tanner. Our schedule now is we have a brief break for, there's a drop of refreshments. There are sources for the next workshop on the tables. You can either sit at the tables or head in about 10 minutes. You going there? Okay. Marianne Novak is going there. Sima Niger is going there. Tzippi Rimmel is going there. And then at 3 o'clock, we have the last. Tzippi Rimmel is going. Where are you going? Sima, where are you going? Wherever you're going. And then at 3 o'clock, we have our last. Great. Even better. You'll sit at the tables. Okay. At 3 o'clock, 3:15, we have the last session. Thank you.
Snyder will be in the back classroom, which is through these doors to the right. And Marianne Novak will be in the main sanctuary on the women's side.